From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
The question is asked of me as of you in different ways. And I am quick to say that I don't feel we should go around saying, as many do, that, you know, it's worse than it ever was and this and that and the other, because that's simply not true. I think that the more near the truth is that we have come a long way since the 60s or the 40s or the 30s or whatever. Longer, the further back you go, the longer way we have come. But that equally clearly we should say we yet have a long way to go. And I think that's where it is. We're in some interim stage and state. I don't know exactly where along the way it is, and neither do you. Nobody does. But we have come a long way.
Alexander Murray Palmer Haley, biographer, scriptwriter, and novelist. Haley is best known as the author of Roots, the saga of an American family, and the autobiography of Malcolm X. As a young boy, he first learned of his African ancestor, Kunta Kinte, by listening to family stories of his maternal grandparents while spending his summer in Henning, Tennessee. After 12 years, Haley's quest to learn more about his family history resulted in him writing the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Roots. The book has been published in 37 languages and was made into the first week-long television miniseries viewed by an estimated 130 million people. Roots also generated widespread interest in genealogy. In 1939, Haley's writing career began when he entered the U.S. Coast Guard. He was the first member of the U.S. Coast Guard with a journalist designation. In 1999, the U.S. Coast Guard honored Haley by naming a Coast Guard cutter after him. Haley's personal motto, quote, "Find the good and praise it," end of quote, appears on the ship emblem. He retired from the military after 20 years of service and then continued writing. Haley was a fascinating storyteller and was in great demand as a lecturer both nationally and internationally. He was on a lecture tour in Seattle, Washington, when he died of a heart attack on February 10, 1992. He was 70 years old. I'm John L. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, a tribute to the late Alex Palmer Haley, In Black America.
Well, it was mostly having begun, and then the more you got, the more deeply you got into it, you were kind of in a position that if you didn't go on, you may as well never have started. You know, you just have such an incremental investment. And also the challenge, you know, you are really kind of at that time fighting a bit of a battle with yourself as to whether or not you've done something worthwhile or something dumb or whatever. And I was frequently having people say to me how dumb this whole thing was. You know, there were people who said that, for one thing, I guess I heard most frequently of all, would come from black scholars who happened to, I would go talking with them about it for one another reason. And a great many of them had the view of, what do you want to resurrect slavery for? And it got to the point that I really quit talking too much about what I was doing. And it was principally a personal challenge to see how far could I go with it. I was astounded that I had been able to get as far as I did at certain points, because it really all had begun with stories told on the front porch of the living room by my grandmother and her sisters.
Haley served in the United States Coast Guard during World War II, the Korean conflict, and the Cold War. He was the first African-American Coast Guardsman in the modern era to reach the rank of Chief Petty Officer. This paved the way for many other African-American men and women to rise into the senior enlisted ranks in the naval services. Haley also holds the distinction of being the first Coast Guardsman to be designated in the specialty rate of journalists in recognition of his able service to the Coast Guard and the Naval's Public Relations and History Program. This was a significant position of responsibility for shaping the public image of the Coast Guard and reporting news within the service, and it broke the previous tradition of black sailors serving mostly exclusively in menial jobs as cooks or stewards. Haley began his writing career with assignments with Reader's Digest and Playboy magazine, where he conducted interviews. During this time, he met Malcolm X, then the spokesperson for Elijah Muhammad's Nation of Islam. Later, he was asked by Malcolm to write his life story. The result of that collaboration, the autobiography of Malcolm X, was published in 1965 and sold 6 million copies. Haley was born on August 11, 1921 in Ithaca, New York. Soon after his birth, he moved to Henning, Tennessee at age 15. He graduated from high school and attended Elizabeth City Teachers College in North Carolina for 2 years. His father persuaded him to join the U.S. Coast Guard. He enlisted in 1939. In January 1977, for 8 consecutive nights, 130 million Americans watched the groundbreaking, history-making saga of an American family who did not come over on the Mayflower or pass through Ellis Island. Roots, the story of Kunta Kinte, a West African enslaved in this country, and his descendants, captivated the American television audience as no other dramatic program had done before. In February 1988, on a trip to Central Texas, In Black America spoke with Alex Haley.
Alex, this is the question I ask all my guests for this year. Do you think the L.A. Lakers can repeat?
Yeah, I think not only they can, I think they will. I'm not... you know, that much into basketball, but what, as little as I am, I do happen to know some of the Lakers, you know, just as friends or acquaintances. And if you're around them, they're kind of like some of the really top-notch Hollywood stars. They have this thing called energy. They could walk in a room behind you, and you would know that somebody had walked in. If Magic Johnson or certainly Kareem or any of the others, that they have that quality about them. I think they will win.
What has Alex Haley been involved with since the TV miniseries Roots and the television program?
Well, a whole variety of things. I have spoken a lot. I have fought the battle of correspondence as best I can, and simply to say that, you know, you get so much mail that comes from people asking things which are very, very personal to them. And I'm very close to my mail, and I hate not to respond to letters, so I try my best to answer as much as I can and still don't do probably half of it. And then I have written some, enough that I'm about, at this time, about 2 weeks away from finishing my next book, the book which will be titled Henning, which is the name of my little hometown in Tennessee. And it should be turned in to the publishers about 4 weeks from now, after I've been able to do 2 weeks' work on it.
I recently returned from Africa, and I got a very good feeling when I got to Senegal and had an opportunity to go to Gori Island and see the slave house. When you went back and doing the research for Roots, what type of an emotional feeling did you feel going back to Africa?
Well, you know, you're kind of in awe, really, if you know the full significance of where you are when you're at Gori. But let me tell you something about you. I was thinking when I walked in that door, I guess you did get an emotional feeling, because if you're around tribes in Africa enough, you get to sort of get some general feeling about tribal configurations, you know, face and all that. And I would bet you, if anything, that if it were possible, you could trace yourself back to your Kunta Kinte. I'll bet you anything you came from the Wolof tribe. You look like a Wolof.
That's what they told me when I was in Dakar.
I know a village, they wouldn't know you left home. That's the truth. You really do have very, very clear Wolof features.
Mm-hmm. When researching Roots, what gave you the inspiration and the energy to undertake such a difficult task?
Well, it was mostly having begun, and then the more you got, the more deeply you got into it, you
were kind of in a position that if you didn't go on, you may as well never have started. You know, you just have such an incremental investment. And also the challenge, you know, you are really kind of at that time fighting a bit of a battle with yourself as to whether or not you've done something worthwhile or something dumb or whatever. And I was frequently having people say to me how dumb this whole thing was. You know, there were people who said that, for one thing, I guess I heard most frequently of all, would come from black scholars who happened to, I would go talking with them about it for one another reason. And a great many of them had the view of, what do you want to resurrect slavery for? And it got to the point that I really quit talking too much about what I was doing. And it was principally a personal challenge to see how far could I go with it. I was astounded that I had been able to get as far as I did at certain points, because it really all had begun with stories told on the front porch of the living room by my grandmother and her sisters about the family. And you know my brother George. George was about 2 years old when I first heard the story of the family going back to the person whom they called, quote, the African, who said his name was Kente. And that meant about as much as, you know, as nothing to me in one sense. And those stories which they told about the family in my mind were sort of corollary to another set of stories I heard in a different locale, and that was biblical parables, you know, like you. Where are you from? Really, I mean, natively.
Namely from Detroit.
Oh, Lord. Well, anyway, I guess you all had Sunday school in Detroit, too,
yes,
but we sure did in Tennessee. But, you know, you tend to learn these things early. And I often think about it, and I sometimes say when talking that I guess when I was about 11 years old, by that time my head was a jumble of stories that I had heard from adults from one another locale. And it was kind of mixed up, like I would, you know, Chicken George and David and Goliath and Miss Kizzy and Moses. They were all kind of mixed up in there. And I would have had to stop and think about where some of them came from.
When you finished the research and you put the manuscript together, did you receive any rejections from publishing houses when you initially tried to get the book published?
No, I didn't. You know, a funny thing is that story, I don't know if you heard it, that, but for quite a time, a story to that effect circulated rather widely, that I had had a very hard time selling it. That's not true at all. The fact was that the publishers practically pulled it out of my typewriter because it had been sold before I finished it. The television rights had been sold. What is her name? Ruby Dee, the actress, Ruby Dee, Ozzy, you know, Ozzy's wife, heard me speaking about the research process. And then she met David Walper, the great producer. And David said something about he was looking for something generational of theme. So Ruby told him about what she had heard me talking about. And David came looking for me, which is sort of like, you know, the mountain Olympus comes to you. And
were you in awe when he called you?
I was in awe. You know, I was. I don't know what the proper word is. I was beyond awe. Moreover, I remember I was in Jamaica in the West Indies because I didn't have enough money to stay here and work. It's cheaper there. And when he called me, he didn't call me, my manager called me, saying that David wanted to buy it, just as outright as that. And I really didn't have money enough to get back to this country. My manager had to send me fare. And so I came on back, and you know, and everything went beautifully. David turned out to be a magnificent guy to work with and learn from. And anyway, I did not have that problem at all of selling it. But rejection slips I got in abundance in my, you know, early years of trying to be a writer. From the time I started, I wrote every day. I was then in the U.S. Coast Guard, and I was writing on ships at night because I was a cook by day. And I got 8 years of steady rejection slips before I sold the first thing, like almost any other writer.
You wrote the autobiography of Malcolm X. During my generation, it was must reading for all college students. How did you come to meet Malcolm Little, letter known as Malcolm X, and the writer's biography.
When I got out of the Coast Guard, I retired. You know, I was I had been in 20 years. I was 37. And the first magazine assignment that I got was from, surprisingly to me, the Reader's Digest, asked if I would do a piece about the organization known colloquially as the Black Muslims, or, you know, the Nation of Islam. And he, Malcolm, was the spokesman. So that was how I first met him. And then subsequently I began to do the interviews for Playboy magazine, and I interviewed him for that. Then a publishing editor, Ken McCormick, a venerable editor, read the Playboy interview and asked Malcolm if he would be willing to tell his life in book-length detail. And Malcolm demurred and, you know, about it. He finally agreed. And then he, Malcolm, asked me if I would write with him the book. And that's how that happened.
There has been generations removed from Malcolm X since his death. What kind of man was Malcolm X, personally and professionally, as you know it?
Often I get asked that, as you would imagine. Usually I try, there's one word above all others. I just say the man was electrical. He really was. I have never known anybody before or since who generated the kind of excitement that he did just in his being and his persona. You know, he lived more than the average 10 men did in his 39 years. He was that, particularly professionally. And then personally, I guess he was also under a lot of pressure, a lot of nervous energy. It was hard for him to sit down like we are sitting. He would be pacing the floor. He was like a caged tiger all the time. He was, it seemed as if he challenged himself to do all that he possibly could do and then a little bit more, that type thing. And together with that, he had a sentimental streak, rarely seen, and little eccentricities, of course. One of them, I remember, he had, when he was in prison, he said that he had almost forgotten in the streets all he had learned in school. So in prison, he decided he would, in effect, kind of re-educate himself. He got, I think it was 12 long legal-length tablets, a gross of pencils, and Webster's Unabridged Dictionary, and he began to write from the first thing in the dictionary to A through Z. And he did that, and he said it just brought back to him much of what education had been for him. And I've talked since with various people in education who say there probably is not a way you could come up as quickly with a rather broad, general, thumbnail sense of the things of the world. But anyway, Malcolm, as a result of that, had an idiosyncrasy, I guess, that every now and then in the heat of the 60s, when he was just, you know, headlines and all that, he would slip away and go up to the New York Museum of Natural History and look at the stuffed aardvark, A-A-R-D-V-A-R-K, because he said it was always fascinating. That was one of the first words he learned because of the double A. So he was an aardvark fancy. Nobody would ever in the world have dreamed that about the fearsome Malcolm X and so on. And I remember one time, it was somehow or other, he had mentioned, maybe his wife, Sister Betty, had mentioned in my hearing that the birthday of their first child, Attila, was coming up. And I knew how Malcolm drove himself. And somehow I remembered, I just thought about it, and I bought a little doll, a little brown doll, who stood maybe 18 inches high with a pretty little dress. And I had this at my place where he would come for me to interview him. And one night I gave it to him and just said, you know, Attila's birthday, and I know you'd want to give her something, and I know you've been so busy to remember it. So here is a gift for you to give her. And I saw him just stand up and weep a little, the fearsome Malcolm. He just really hadn't thought about it, you know, and he was always so grateful. And as a matter of fact, that doll still exists. Attila is now, she's my godchild. And Attila now is a long-legged, I call her Little Red. She looks like her father, acts like him, actually. And she still has the doll, yeah.
This is the 20th year of the Kerner Commission. Your particular assessment of black America here in the 80s?
Well, often the question is asked of me as of you in different ways. And I am quick to say that I don't feel we should go around saying, as many do, that, you know, it's worse than it ever was and this and that and the other, because that's simply not true. I think that the more near the truth is that we have come a long way since the 60s or the 40s or the 30s or whatever. Longer, the further back you go, the longer way we have come. But that equally clearly we should say we yet have a long way to go. And I think that's where it is. We're in some interim stage and state. I don't know exactly where along the way it is, and neither do you. Nobody does. But we have come a long way.
There was a bit of history made 2 weeks ago when Doug Williams quarterbacked the Washington Redskins to the World Championship of Football.
Yeah.
How did you feel when Washington won?
Well, I felt fine, and I was really particularly feeling what you said at the outset. I have heard that what had become a cliche, as a matter of fact, beforehand, that no black quarterback could quarterback a major team. And so my thinking about it, as a matter of fact, his manager called my office in Los Angeles and asked if I would be willing to write a book about Doug Williams. And I told him I admired Doug Williams very much. I just simply can't, you know, take on the writing of a book. But I knew, you know who I thought about? I thought about Doug Williams, but I thought as much about Eddie Robinson, who coached him at Grambling. Mm-hmm. You know, Eddie Robinson is a living legend. And you sort of think about it, suppose Eddie Robinson had been able to been the coach of such a team, the man who did so much with a little cow pasture college. And I'm not putting down on Grambling. I'm just talking about Grambling is on what was at one time a cow pasture. And so I just felt that Doug Williams really sort of personified the potentials that are out there in many, many other areas. I'm all for sports, but I think that I would like to see, if we're talking about us, you know, black mm-hmm. people, I would just like to see us become top quarterback in other areas than sports. Sports is fine. I'm not knocking that. Please
industry.
Understand. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, it's like, you know, one of the most graphic things, if you want to look at things like that, is you open the whatever the local newspaper is, I don't know, and turn it to the sports section today, tomorrow, last week, next week, and probably half the photographs in the sports section would be black men and now women in some sports or other, often triumphant and so forth. And then turn to the next section, the business section, and you will turn all year long and you'll probably not see a single picture. That is the graphic thing that needs to be altered. That's in that area that we talk about, we have a long way to go thing.
The late Alex Palmer Haley. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, write us. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at KUT.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producers Cliff Hargrove and David Alvarez, I'm John L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.